You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening today. This hour, we're taking on myths and fake news about the pandemic. You know those social media posts that say the virus was deliberately created and released by some bad actor? That's false. Or injecting disinfectants into your body will protect you from the virus? Also false. Or this novel coronavirus is no more deadly than the influenza that circulates seasonally each year? Again, that is false. Those examples might all be obvious, but you'd be surprised how much fake news about the virus is floating around out there. Last month, the chief medical officer for CVS, the drugstore chain, sent an email to employees that included information that claimed drinking warm water could, quote, wash the virus into the stomach where the virus is killed. Pew Research found that nearly half of their respondents had read fake news related to the pandemic. So today, I think, is a pretty important opportunity to elevate science-based fact and clear up any confusion about sketchy information that you've heard. So I'd like to hear from you. Are you wondering about some virus-related information that you've spotted on Facebook or Twitter? Has a friend or family member said something that doesn't sound quite right, and you want to know what the truth is so you can share it with that friend or family? So where are you seeing the most misinformation about the pandemic and the virus, the science, the spread, the transmission? And have you encountered someone in your circle, socially distanced, of course, that has said something about the virus that doesn't sound quite right? And you want to know what the truth is? We'll take your calls and your questions and your tweets on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Our guest this hour, Dr. Angela Hewitt, is the medical director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit. She's also an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And with us from Omaha, Dr. Hewitt, it's good to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Dr. Krutika Kupali is with us, infectious disease physician and vice chair of the IDSA Global Health Committee. She's also a biosecurity fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and she's with us today from Palo Alto. And Dr. Kupali, really good to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kupali, I'm going to start with you. I think we should acknowledge that a lot of us, you know, knew very little. We lay men and women knew very little about infectious disease and transmission and epidemiology. And we've had a rather steep learning curve. Can we be given, I guess, a little bit of grace about the fact that we've had to learn the kind of stuff that you've known for a long time?
Sure, absolutely. We in the infectious disease field in particular, we spent years learning about how infectious diseases are transmitted, how to prevent acquisition of these diseases. And so this is definitely not something that we learn overnight. And so the lay public has definitely received a crash course in how to prevent these diseases and how to manage it. Definitely, it's important to remember that this is not something that has been part of the lay public's muscle memory, so to speak, for years. And it will take time to learn how to deal with these things. That being said, I think it's really important for people who don't deal with infectious diseases on a daily basis to look to our public health experts on how to manage and prevent all infectious diseases, but particularly COVID-19 during this important time.
Yeah, I'm really glad, Dr. Hewitt, I'm really glad that Dr. Kupali said that, because I saw a poll over the weekend, Times Post, some Gallup maybe, that said that medical professionals such as yourselves are held in very high trusted regard by Americans. I think it was above 70%, which makes where you get your information ever more important, right? Go to the sources. Would you just at the beginning of the show here tell us about some of the places that you believe Americans can go to find the most trusted information on this?
Well, so, you know, obviously there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think, you know, social media is definitely a wonderful format, actually, for good information, but also can definitely be a format for, you know, for fake news and misinformation as well. And that's really what we're seeing with this. There are some reliable sources out there. You know, I would say that obviously the Centers for Disease Control, you know, it does have a website that has a lot of good information on it. And that is vetted by, you know, public health professionals, physicians, you know, nurses, others who really know about this stuff. I think that's typically where, you know, where the U.S. turns to when we're looking for good information. The other local, you know, assets are just your local health department. Our local health department, and I'm sure, you know, yours and everyone's, has actually a pretty good website that has a lot of information on their website that can be very helpful. And so I would look to those specific entities that are well vetted, you know, that do represent our public health community, as opposed to, you know, to the random stuff that you see on social media.
It's good to hear you say that. And I feel like this is pretty obvious, but, you know, begin with your health department, begin with the CDC. You can use Johns Hopkins, but I don't know. We seem to be drowning in the kind of information that just comes at us on social media. So I think it bears explaining. I wanted to ask you another question before we go to the phone lines. Dr. Hewlett, is the all of this false information online, do you think much of it is coming from malevolent forces who are trying to harm people? Or is it coming from people that just don't know and they're passing it on, thinking, where's the harm? This is what's out there. People ought to know this.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say most of the misinformation that I've seen doesn't appear to come from individuals trying to cause harm. I think what it is people are just grasping. You know, they're grasping for to come up with something that could, you know, could help people in this, you know, in this crisis. And most of the things that I've seen have had things to do with various vitamins or, you know, other, you know, supplements or, you know, vitamin C and, you know, kind of things like that, that a lot are kind of home remedies. Now, that being said, there are definitely some very dangerous, you know, elements of misinformation out there. And I know you mentioned earlier about the, you know, injecting disinfectants.
Right.
This is something that, when that was mentioned, I'll tell you what, all of us in the infectious disease community were just floored by that, thinking, you know, and probably poison control and lots of others, you know, thinking, you know, people, this could obviously cause a lot of deaths and, you know, and harm to people. And so there's definitely dangerous misinformation out there. But I believe that most of the stuff that I've seen has really been more, you know, let's try to grasp at something that maybe works for another disease or some sort of vitamin or supplement that we have around the house or is easily available that could maybe help.
I'm really glad you mentioned the disinfectant. That came from President Trump. We have an excerpt of what he said about that. And Dr. Kupali, we're going to knock this down. So listen to what the president said.
It seems to be a extra line of defense, and it's gotten tremendous reviews from some people, including many, many doctors all over the world. And you should look at some of the studies. They've been amazing, some of the studies. But that's up to people, and it's up, I think, strongly recommend to people with their doctors' advice and acknowledgement.
So that is, I think, the same press conference where the president also talked about hydroxychloroquine. You know, Dr. Kupali, he references all these research studies and tremendous reviews, and now we know that it is not recommended. How do we understand what we hear from the leader of the country on, at that point, was incomplete science?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it can be really challenging because people want to believe our leaders and want to listen to them. You know, I think that one of the important things in this situation in particular is, once again, President Trump is the leader of the country, but he's not a scientist. And I think that's a really important thing for people to remember. I think that people need to look to our scientists and our public health experts for the scientific information when it comes to recommendations on treatments, on therapeutics, especially in a situation like this where we're dealing with a brand new infectious diseases that we don't still know a great deal amount, a deal of information about. You know, we're still only 6 months into this infection. We're still learning a lot of information about it. And so I think it's really important to listen to the scientific information that's coming out as we do studies and learn more about the medications that are going to work against it. And, you know, I think President Trump is great at getting up there and making broad generalizing statements, but he's not a scientist.
Good point. Dr. Kupali and Dr. Hewlett with us this morning. If you're just getting in on the show, and we are aware that there was a lot of misinformation, some of it deliberately malevolent, a lot of it just incomplete science or misunderstood science or people just passing it on from social media. We thought it was time to do a fact and fiction conversation. And I have a feeling we'll do this again as more and more information comes out and the pandemic continues. So are you wondering about some virus-related information that you've spotted on social media, you heard from a friend, you gathered, at your church or at a picnic, and you heard people talking about this, and you thought, could that be true? What is that? Has a friend or family shared something that you're just not sure about? This is an opportunity to ask those questions. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR. I just want to let you know we have some breaking news here on the U.S. Supreme Court. They have ruled on this Louisiana abortion law, and it looks like Chief Justice Roberts has sided with the liberal justices to block this abortion law. Phil Picardi will have more at the bottom of the hour. Okay, to the phones here to Malta in Minneapolis. Malta, thanks so much for waiting. Really appreciate it. What are you thinking about?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm sort of wondering, you know, we're talking about misinformation, deliberate and accidental, and I kind of think it's interesting that, you know, we were told at the beginning of this whole pandemic that masks were not effective for protecting you, and you really don't need a mask. And then it went to, well, you just need to wear a mask if you're taking care of somebody that has it. And then they also said, well, masks only, you know, prevent you from spreading the disease. They don't keep you from getting the disease. Now they've come out and flipped that around and said, no, it does protect you and everybody should be wearing a mask. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the other day Fauci was asked about this and why they originally said that masks were not effective. And his answer was, well, we were worried we did not have enough masks for the people on the front lines. So we lied to everybody about the effectiveness of the mask.
Wait a minute. Did Dr. Fauci use the word lie, or that's your interpretation?
Well, I don't see any other way you could interpret it. He said that they gave misinformation in order to protect the frontline workers.
Okay, so I'm really glad you asked this question. Dr. Hewlett, this has been confusing for people, including me. He's right. We were getting recommendations that we didn't need masks because we needed to save them for healthcare workers. What happened?
Well, and I appreciate being able to respond to this because I've been kind of preaching this for a while. Many of us in infectious diseases, and public health early on did say that we didn't think that masks were necessary, particularly in the public. Now, I will say that was based on what we knew thus far, and we're talking about very early in this pandemic. So something like January, February time, that sort of thing, before things really, you know, took off with a vengeance in the United States. And so we really have never encountered anything like this before, you know, particularly in our lifetimes. And so we kind of went with what we typically do for influenza. And we don't recommend people wear masks all over the place in public for influenza. But I'll tell you what, there has been a huge reckoning within, all of our communities in the scientific communities, basically with, you know, with what information we have now, particularly some studies that have come out looking at the efficacy of masks and the efficacy, particularly the masking the individual that could be infected, and the fact that, you know, when you're containing those secretions, your likelihood of spreading those secretions around is, you know, is significantly lower. And so I will say that, and to comment about the, you know, the medical frontline workers, you know, when a lot of us originally said we didn't think masks were necessary, it actually was not because we wanted to protect for the frontline workers, although that's, you know, obviously something we think about. But really, it was because we didn't know. And I'll be the first to say we didn't know. And so now we've learned so much. And just the transmissibility of this is something that is absolutely staggering. You have people that are asymptomatic, have zero symptoms, and yet they have very high viral loads in their noses, and they're able to transmit to others who can get very sick. And so, you know, early on, we didn't know that. And now we know. And because of that, we really do recommend that we protect particularly, you know, the individual that may be shedding virus, even asymptomatic, by using that mask. And so, again, I'll be the first to admit that many of us originally thought that these were not necessary, but I am absolutely 100% now committed to the fact, based on what I know and what I've seen, you know, with COVID.
I'm really glad to hear you note that the science is evolving. I'm going to come back to that. And just, you know, how to understand that the research continues in real time, right? And some of the recommendations will change because of that. Dr. Krupali, let me take another mask question here from Laverne in Fargo. Hi, Laverne.
Hi.
What are you hearing?
Just like the previous caller, I'm hearing more than what he said, which is the masks don't do anything to protect us. And in fact, they're making us sicker. So that's my first question. And I just, you know, what I heard her say was, no, they're helping, that science is evolving. But this person was clear, and he had studies to back it up, and he told me where to go. And so I guess I just want to hear some more about the mask.
Sure.
How are masks protecting us? And is there a chance that they're making us sicker? That's my first question. And then number two is, I heard that some of my friends told me that the alcohol in some of the hand sanitizers is destroying a layer of skin and making us more susceptible.
Okay. Laverne, thanks for the questions. Dr. Krupali, are you back? Or no, we're still...
Yes, I am.
Good, good, good. Did you hear those questions?
I did not.
All right. Yeah. Laverne said she was at in conversation with a friend who cited a bunch of studies, who said, in fact, the masks aren't protecting us. They are making us sicker. Will you add some context onto what Dr. Hewlett just said about masking?
So, unfortunately, my line disconnected, so I didn't get to hear what Dr. Hewlett said about masking. But there is no information that shows that masks make us sicker. You know, one of the things that I continually tell people when they make comments about wearing masks and how, you know, masks are making them difficult for them to breathe, or any of those things are, you know, I have friends that are surgeons who wear masks in the operating room for hours and hours on end, and they've been doing so for years and years, and they've been completely fine. That being said, I think that, you know, I'm going to reiterate the point that the reason that we recommend mask wearing at this point in time is we're in a situation where we have to assume that everybody has COVID-19. And because there's a lot of information about how COVID-19 can spread during the asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic phase, that is a big reason as to why we recommend everybody wearing masks. I'm going to reiterate that there's no data out there that shows that wearing a mask can make you sick. In fact, in our immune-compromised patient population, we recommend that they wear masks to prevent them from getting things like fungal infections. So I guess that's probably where I'm going to leave that.
Okay, good. And Laverne, I would just say, I know you know, you're in a moment where somebody's giving you a lot of information. You might just say, I think if you test that theory against the CDC and the Johns Hopkins site, you're going to find that it's not true. I mean, go right site, you know, right to the source and send these people that are spreading misinformation like that to that source. Dr. Hewlett, Laverne also asked about this alcohol in the wipes destroying a layer of the skin. That's not true, is it?
No, I mean, I haven't seen anything that said that. Now, what I have seen, which is true, is there's a variety of different components to alcohol gels and solutions. And, you know, typically the stuff that you would normally buy pre-COVID was you know, the ethanol solution that we would, you know, it was either 65 or 70%, something along those lines. And that's, we've been using that in hospitals for years. Now, though, there are a lot of people manufacturing alcohol products, you know, for use on for hand hygiene. The problem is that some of those products are made from alcohols that are not safe. And so I saw something recently where they, I believe it's the FDA, actually released a list of products that actually contain, I believe it was methanol. And so a different type of alcohol that can cause problems. And
okay.
So you just have to be very, you know, you have to be very careful about where you're getting your products. And when you, before you buy a product, you need to look on the back and see, you know, see what it contains. And there are actually quite a few reliable sources. FDA is one. You know, looking for specific components to different products and making sure that that's safe. So I guess the typical products that you would think about using alcohol hand gel wise are fine. And we've been, again, using those in the hospital for years and years and years with no problems whatsoever. That being said, there are people that are, you know, making products now out of desperation that may contain things that are not good for you. So,
okay. Good to know.
I would just review your product selection.
So you just want to, I mean, if you're buying the standard alcohol wipes that you would get in the drugstore or the grocery store, you should be fine if you're not buying.
Exactly.
Okay. A call here from Megan in Northfield. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
What are you interested in? What are you curious about?
Yeah, so we brought our 5-year-old into therapy, and it was the first visit. So the psychologist was just gathering information about, like, how we responded to the pandemic, and we were saying that within the last month we have returned to going to parks with our kids. And she had said that, well, the virus is killed in the sun within 20 minutes. And part of me was, like, relieved, but I was also in my head, like, is that really true? So, just curious about that.
Sure. Dr. Kripali, does the virus die in 20 minutes in the sunlight?
That's a great question. You know, again, as far as I know, most of the information that we know about currently in regards to the virus is how long it lives on different surfaces. You know, I think that we're still learning information about how heat, humidity, temperature can affect the duration of how long the virus can live. But you also need to think about how long the virus has been on the surface and also the type of surface the virus is on. So I wouldn't say you can say a broad generalizing statement of the virus would be dead within a certain period of time. There's a lot of different things that will affect that. At the end of the day, if you know you're taking your kid to somewhere like a playground, the most important thing would be to continue to be adamant about hand hygiene, because you don't want your child to be touching dirty surfaces and then potentially self-contaminating their mouth, their nose, or their eyes, and auto-infecting themselves, and also being around other children that could potentially spread COVID-19 to themselves.
And even though we have seen some of the studies about surfaces where that is much less influential, I guess, in the way it transmits, it's much more the community, person-to-person, aerosolized spread, right? Just be aware, though, where your child might be, you know, running their hands over surfaces and then putting their hands in their mouths or something.
Yes, absolutely. While we do know that we can get some spread from people touching surfaces and then touching their hands to their mouth with a dirty hand, the main route of transmission is going to be the spread from droplet transmission.
Okay. Katie in Minneapolis called. She says, my employers are still talking about masks making people faint. I work in sales, so we have to wear masks while we sit at our desks and talk on the phone. And on Twitter, Mallory tells me the masks making people sicker lie is from the propaganda film Plandemic. I wasn't aware of this. She says, in which a disgraced former scientist claimed that you're breathing it in and fueling it with your own breath. pure nonsense. Dr. Hewlett, okay, you've covered your mouth with a cloth mask and you're breathing it. Are you reinfecting yourself because you're wearing something cloth over your mouth and nose?
No. Okay. I mean, the answer to that is no.
I know, this sounds crazy, but...
Right. Well, but I will say, I actually did watch a little bit of that Plandemic just because I had seen it kind of circulating around on social media. And I'll tell you, nowadays, responding to misinformation, including this one on social media, is absolutely exhausting. I do my best with my, you know, friend group within, you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. But I'll tell you what, it is very difficult because there's just so much out there. And I mean, Plandemic is one of those things that you watch that and we are just, I mean, I was like in awe of the kind of ridiculousness of some
really?
Of those in there.
Really?
So, but it depends. You know, if you're a non-healthcare worker, scientist, you may watch that, and it is very compelling. You know, it may be that it does seem that some of that may be plausible. But again, those of us in the public health community and infectious diseases, it was pretty disturbing to watch. The comment about the mask making you sicker, though, I think is one that I've seen a whole lot. And I want to go back to what Dr. Kripalu said about, you know, we've been wearing masks for years, we in the medical community, and particularly the surgeons. And she mentioned the surgeons who wear masks for hours and hours, sometimes,
right.
You know, 10, 12 longer hours during an operative procedure. And, you know, the purpose of that mask is not to protect the surgeon. It's actually to protect the patient who's being operated on so that the surgeon doesn't cough any of their, you know, secretions onto the patient's wounds that are open. So that it's very analogous, actually, to what we're using masks for here. And that we're really trying to use masks to protect the person that is, maybe opposite of the infected individual. So you're wearing a mask to protect others. And if both parties are wearing a mask actually does provide some degree of protection, for the wearer as well. And so if you've got, you know, two people having a conversation, standing, you know, a reasonable distance apart wearing a mask, like she mentioned with some, you know, in a workplace, the risk of transmission there is going to be much lower. And so I would just say that, you know, there have been lots of people wearing masks for prolonged periods of time for years and years, and we have not seen any detrimental effects, in those individuals. And so we really need to use our medical community particularly as an example of the reason why, you know, how we can wear masks safely.
That's good. Dr. Angela Hewitt is with us. She's medical director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit with us from Omaha. Dr. Krutika Kripalu is with us, an infectious diseases physician and vice chair of the IDSA Global Health Committee from Palo Alto. Taking your calls and your questions, your genuine curiosity, your confusion about some of the things that you've seen about the pandemic on social media or been told by friends and family or had a conversation with somebody at a church gathering or something, and someone came up armed with a bunch of studies and information that just sounded off, just sounded weird. So we're taking your calls and your questions about that. 651-227-6000 to Kelly in Prior Lake. Hi, Kelly. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, no problem.
What's your question? What's your story here?
I have an 80-year-old father who gets most of his information from Fox News, and in the last week he's had two doozies for me that I'd be curious about your opinions on. Mm-hmm. One is he thinks that 70% of us are going to end up getting this virus anyway, so why bother trying to prevent it? And the second thing is that he heard that the mortality rate, or that he called it the death rate, is going down and is much less lethal than originally thought. And I know that's a confusing statistic for people, so I'd be curious about the thoughts on that. I know there's infection death rate and mortality rate and whatever. So is this virus more lethal than we thought or less lethal than we thought initially?
Okay, two really good questions. Dr. Kripalu, we have had Dr. Michael Osterholm from the University of Minnesota on the show many times. He is one of the people who says, in the end, 60 to 70% of us are going to be exposed to this virus. The idea is that we're not all exposed and needing medical care and hospital care at the same time. Does Kelly's dad have the outline of that basically right?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I definitely think that, you know, as time goes on, we are going to see more and more people exposed to the virus. But I think that you hit the nail on the head. We don't want everybody exposed to the virus at the same time. We see the repercussions of that going on right now in the Southeast, where we see hospitals in places like the Texas Medical Center at full capacity and unable to take really any more sick patients, or places like Arizona and Florida, where healthcare systems are now also at full capacity. The other thing we do need to also keep in mind is, right, we're still learning a lot more about the transmission dynamics of the disease, the long-term healthcare repercussions of the disease. Those are things that we just don't know because we've only been in this pandemic for 6 months. And so, you know, that's why we think it's important to try and help prevent the transmission and acquisition of the disease. And in regards to your second question, I think that's also another really important thing to keep in mind. So first of all, we have rapidly increased testing in the United States, which is great and important. And so as you increase testing and potentially have the ability to detect more of the less symptomatic cases, you are going to see the fatality rate go down. One thing that we do need to keep in mind as well right now is that as we see cases surge in the United States, typically we're going to see deaths lag behind the number of cases by a couple of weeks. So I think that those are a couple of things that we just need to keep in mind.
Dr. Hewlett, I just want to emphasize again that and it sounds like you and Dr. Kupali agree with this, that until we get a vaccine, 60 to 70% of us are likely to be exposed, but we don't want that exposure to happen all simultaneously. But essentially, that exposure prediction is right. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. It kind of depends, though, on what we do over this time period. And what we're really trying to do is to really just try to buy time until
right.
we have, you know, a vaccine, or we have maybe a preventative medication that we can give to people who are exposed to make them, you know, not become ill, or even a more effective treatment for people who become ill to keep them from being critically ill or from dying. And so all we're trying to do is really buy time here. You know, the problem is if 70% of individuals in the United States get sick with this, I mean, there's a very wide spectrum of illness. So, you know, you can have absolutely no symptoms at all, or you can be critically ill, you know, and be at risk of death.
Right.
And the problem is if 70% of people in the United States become ill, this would be catastrophic as far as our number of deaths that we're going to see, particularly in our vulnerable populations and older populations. And so, you know, what we're really trying to do is to not have that happen all at once, particularly because if we can buy some time and have it be more of a gradual process, and we'll still have those ICU beds available, we'll still be able to take care of patients as opposed to experiencing the big surge, you know, as we're seeing in the South. As Dr. Pauly mentioned, I'm from Houston originally, and I'll tell you, it is absolutely paining me in a huge way to see what's going on at the Texas Medical Center right now. I mean, this is, you know, the largest medical facility in the world, and they have a lot of beds, and they take care of very sick patients all the time. And they are struggling right now. And it's very, very painful to see this type of surge causing such a, you know, a difficult scenario for our medical communities and for the people in general. Because remember, you know, when our hospitals run out of beds or run out of equipment or personnel, then it's, you know, it's people who are sick who tend to suffer because there may not be that bed available or that ventilator available. So we really need to do everything we can to try to at least, you know, if we're going to build up to that 60-70%, do it very gradually as opposed to having these big surges where lots of people get sick at the same time.
Yeah. So, Kelly, if you're still listening, I mean, the answer to your dad is yes, 60 to 70% of us may end up being exposed, but let's not be sanguine about that. We don't want so many people getting sick at the same time, especially your dad, who I think you said was in his 70s or 80s. So, okay, call here from Tamir in Minneapolis. Hi, Tamir.
Hello.
Hi.
So my question is, I've had several friends tell me, including one that works in healthcare, that the transfer of this virus to you via things you touch is very low. And the friend in healthcare even said that he does not wash his hands any more than he did pre-pandemic. Every time I try to find information about this, I can't find any studies in peer-reviewed journals. So I'm wondering if you guys have some quantifiable data of what your chances are of getting this through things you touch.
Dr. Hewlett, back to you on that one.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, I want to say, if he's anything like me, this healthcare worker, he may have been washing his hands a whole lot to begin with prior to the pandemic, probably more than the general right. population. So it may be that that person is not washing their hands anymore, but you know, again, they may have been washing their hands a lot to begin with. We can talk about surface contamination and surface transmission, or what we call fomites, you know, the potential for inanimate objects to transmit an illness. And in this disease, we know that that's not the primary mode of transmission. We know that people group together, you know, and that droplet of potentially airborne transmission is really, really what we're worried about. The surface transmission, though, you know, theoretically, it is a possibility, and that if you have a high, you know, amount of virus on a surface, and this is analogous to influenza. You know, you always hear, you know, don't touch the doorknob and then touch your face, you know, because if someone wiped their nose and they have a lot of virus, you know, on their hands, and then they immediately touch the doorknob and you come right after them and touch the doorknob and then you touch your face, then yeah, there's a potential for transmission that way. But, you know, I do agree with what they've been saying, and that we know that this is not the primary mode of transmission. We know, though, that hand washing is good for a variety of things, and that, you know, we should continue to do that, you know, after touching surfaces or having contact with, you know, with surfaces that other people touch. And I do that, you know, I think we all do in the healthcare community out of just our usual practice and what we, you know, what we normally do in the hospital. And so I guess I would say I do agree that that fomite or inanimate object transmission is not the primary mode here. And what we really, really need to focus on is not necessarily, you know, wiping down all of your, you know, boxes from Amazon or your, you know, groceries or things like that, but really staying away from other people, because that's really how this is transmitted.
Good. Dr. Kripali, a question here again about data's coming in. This was a new virus. How should we non-scientists understand the way scientific research evolves as you get more information? So we're not walking around going, but 4 months ago you told me this and now it's this. I just want a little more understanding about how we should all think about that.
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, I think it is also really important to remember that this is a new virus and we are constantly learning more information. Science is not static, and because of that and the new information that we're learning on really an hourly basis, the recommendations are changing, and it is important to keep up with the new updated information that's coming out. I think that for the lay public in general, the best way to keep up with that information is looking at things like your local public health department, as Dr. Hewlett mentioned earlier, and also the more reputable public health agencies. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, the WHO website, and then I'm going to also make a plug for the Infectious Disease Society of America website, www.idsociety.org. We have been curating all the information that's been out there as well, and trying to maintain up-to-date information as well. I think that's really the best way to stay up with the information that's the most recent and also the most relevant, so you don't get bogged down in information that might not actually be scientifically sound.
Dr. Hewlett, that makes a lot of sense. I guess I was also thinking it is the, as Dr. Kripali said at the beginning, it is the nature of science to change as more data comes in. So I you constantly hear people saying, well, you know, at the beginning in February, we heard this, and it must have been wrong, because now, you know, I want people to understand it is the very character of scientific research for it to build and change. Will you just say a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so you hit the nail on the head. I mean, 100%. That's exactly how science works. You know, as we learn more and we have more scientific studies, recommendations do change. Now, I will say that this is a bit different just in the rapidity of the information that we're receiving. So just the fact that, you know, we've only been involved in this, you know, this pandemic for a few months. And if you look at any of the medical journals now or, you know, any public health website, it is overwhelming. All the medical journals have papers on, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a gastroenterology journal, there's a paper on COVID and, you know, patients with stomach problems or whatever else. So we're receiving a lot of information very, very quickly. And that's really different than typically, like, say, you know, you want new information about treatments for diabetes. Well, that's more of a gradual process, and because diabetes has been around for a long time and maybe a new medication, you know, is being studied. But this is like definitely like nothing I've ever seen, just in the amount of information that has been generated in a short period of time. And it is difficult to keep up. It's difficult for the medical community to keep up. It's definitely difficult for the public to keep up and to know, you know, what's right and what isn't, because things are changing so rapidly. So, yeah, this is a normal function of how science works, but it is just occurring at a much more rapid pace.
That's like on warp speed, right? Spectrum,
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Okay. So at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about how you should get your information on this from high-quality sources. But it is inevitable that we are going to hear things from our government leaders because they're helping to manage the pandemic. So here in Minnesota, we've been at the state legislature having a debate about how quickly to open up, how long should the lockdown have continued. And this is something that the Senate majority leader, I'm sorry, Paul Gazelka, said recently about where the greatest threat of the cases are.
July 12th, if he brings us back, it's because the emergency powers have ended. And we will vote again to remove those. There is no emergency. COVID-19 is serious, but it was not what we thought it was going to be. The governor predicted 40,000 deaths if we sheltered in place. That was his first prediction. Well, now we're not even, you know, we're nowhere near 2,000 deaths.
So, Dr. Hewlett, is COVID-19 not the emergency that we thought it was?
Well, that depends on where you are.
I guess it does, right?
What did
you think it was, right?
If you're in Phoenix, Arizona right now, or Houston, Texas, or, you know, that sort of thing, or if you were in New York a couple of months ago, it is definitely that emergency. But what we want to do, and we're experiencing a similar scenario here in Nebraska, that, you know, we have gradually reopened things, and we're not experiencing that surge of cases. But as Dr. Capone mentioned, we also have to remember that there's a 2 to 3 week lag time behind, you know, people being, you know, exposed to this virus, getting sick, and then actually presenting for medical care. And so what we're dealing with now in the hospital is indicative of what was happening 2 or 3 weeks ago in the community. And so that's the problem, is we reopen gradually. We really don't know, are opening things to 100% capacity going to generate, you know, those a surge in cases? But in communities where there is not a huge surge, I think things can be opened up safely with stipulations of people, you know, social distancing. I do think masks are important. And I would say that that's the way that we can keep the economy going, is really to try to open things safely, as opposed to doing, and again, my home, Texas is my home state, but as opposed to doing what has happened in the South, Texas included, where they reopened things and then had to walk back because they're seeing this huge surge in cases. So now the bars are closed again and the restaurants are, you know, decreasing capacity. And so, you know, that's what you don't want to do, is to open things and see this huge surge and then have to walk back on your recommendations. So if you follow the advice of your public health leaders, there's a way to do this safely, but that needs to be a very close relationship between the public health leaders and the governmental officials in order to do this right.
Yeah, communication is really, really essential here. Dr. Capali, this is worse than the seasonal influenza that we experience, yes?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's worse than seasonal influenza for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it's a new pathogen. you know, we've had influenza around for a very long time. We understand influenza, and we have therapeutics against influenza. We don't understand this coronavirus, and that makes it very difficult to effectively prevent. We're learning more and more about COVID-19, which is great, but we don't have a great therapeutic against it yet. Remdesivir is helpful, but it's not a slam dunk therapeutic. We don't have any sort of vaccine against COVID-19. So that's another challenge. And that's a couple of the reasons why it is such a scary infection. And we still don't know anything about the long-term health consequences of COVID-19. We've heard so many different things that are coming out now in the months after people have been infected, but we don't know really much about the long-term health consequences that we will see in 3 months, 6 months, a year after people have been infected. So I think those are things people really need to think about.
Dr. Kupali, a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to grab one last call here from Wendy in Isanti. Hi, Wendy. What's your question?
Hi, I read an article this week that said some of the people that have recovered from COVID have internal damage to their organs, and they're saying it's from COVID. I'm wondering if that's true or not.
Dr. Hewlett, what do we know about that?
Yeah, so we are learning a lot about that, as Dr. Kupali mentioned, you know, really on a daily basis. But yes, we're definitely seeing patients who recover who have a lot of problems. And so this is not something where you get sick and, you know, for a few days and then you recover and, you know, go back to your kind of normal state. There are a lot of people who actually have, you know, very prolonged illnesses even after their kind of recovery from the more severe part of the illness. We've seen, you know, heart damage, lung damage, obviously, you know, damage to various gastrointestinal organs. People, and particularly if you become critically ill and spend time in the ICU, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of problems that result. And so even when people recover from COVID itself, they face a really uphill battle, actually, to get back to, you know, to their usual functional status before the disease. So it's some pretty scary stuff, actually, to see.
Dr. Hewlett, really a pleasure, always. Thank you so much for the time and the insight.
No problem, though. No. Nice to be here.
Dr. Angela Hewlett with us. She's medical director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit, and Dr. Krutika Kupali, infectious diseases physician, vice chair of the IDS Global Health Committee. Now, we tackled a lot of your questions and your curiosity, and I think this is the kind of high quality information and news and source that you expect. I hope that's worth a commitment to Minnesota Public Radio. We've got a little mini membership drive going on here at the end of June. Double your donation for free and independent radio today, thanks to a gift from Thomson Reuters. They're matching the first $1,000 donated each hour. If you can see your way clear to making a contribution, it would be much appreciated. NPRnews.org/donate. And thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.